Welcome to the Republican Professor, you great inflators and great inflated people. I don't know if you're a great inflator or not. I'm just giving you a hard time. I hope you're not. I'm not. And I wasn't great inflated for the most part either. I went through some hard stuff, which is why I'm so hard on everybody else. But welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It is Tuesday, 23 September 2025, years after Jesus. We have a reading from Psalm 63, Streams in the Desert, and we're getting back into the 40th anniversary celebration of Richard A. Epstein's Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, published by Harvard University Press, 1985, 40 years ago. We're going to finish one of his chapters and talk about judicial activism versus judicial restraint. That's the topic today in the context of private property and the U.S. Constitution. Psalm 63. O God, you are my God. I earnestly seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you. In a dry and weary land where there is no water. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory, because your love is better than life. My lips will glorify you. I will praise you as long as I live, and in your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with the richest of foods. With singing lips my mouth will praise you. On my bed, I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night, because you are my help. I sing in the shadow of your wings. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. They who seek my life will be destroyed. They will go down to the depths of the earth. They will be given over to the sword and become food for jackals. But the king will rejoice in God. All who swear by God's name will praise him, while the mouths of liars will be silenced. That's Psalm 63. A moment of silence for you to reflect. Now we have a reading from Streams in the Desert, Kalman Publications, Las Vegas Station, Los Angeles, California, 1925, the original non-woke edition. Although I can't promise you any politically incorrect gems in this particular one, but January 7th, page 7. I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content. Philippians 4:11. Paul, denied of every comfort, wrote the above words into his garden one morning. I'm sorry. I'm seeing double. I don't know why. I'm sober. Paul, denied of every comfort, wrote the above words in his dungeon. A story is told of a king who went into his garden one morning and found everything withered and dying. He asked the oak that stood near the gate what the trouble was. He found it was sick. He found it was sick of life, and determined to die because it was not tall and beautiful like the pine. The pine was all out of heart because it could not bear grapes like the vine. The vine was going to throw its life away because it could not stand erect and have as fine fruit as the peach tree. The geranium was fretting because it was not tall and fragrant like the lilac, and so on all through the garden. Coming to a heart's ease, he found its bright face lifted as cheery as ever. Well, page 8 at the top, heart's ease. I'm glad, amidst all this discouragement, to find one brave little flower. You do not seem to be the least disheartened. No, I'm not of much account, but I thought that if you wanted an oak or a pine or a peach tree or a lilac, you would have planted one. But as I knew you wanted a heart's ease, I'm determined to be the best little heart's ease that I can. Others may do a greater work, but you have your part to do. No one in all God's heritage can do it as well as you. They who are God's without reserve are in every state content, for they will only what he wills and desire to do for him whatever he desires them to do. They strip themselves of everything and in this nakedness find all things restored and hundredfold. Streams in the Desert, January 8th. Miss Chas E. Kalman. Kalman Publications. An interesting little tidbit of this book, how it connects with me. Maybe it's interesting, maybe it's not to you. I'm reading a biography of a man named Oswald Chambers, and he went to Japan before the First World War. This was several years before the First World War. His traveling companion there was a Japanese man, and that Japanese man's great great granddaughter was at my grandfather's funeral just a few months ago. And I'd met her before. I met him at my grandfather's 100th birthday. Well, anyway, Kalman, the guy that wrote this, was a missionary in Japan and knew that guy. So there's connections all over the place here. It's just wonderful. We're going to get into Richard A. Epstein's takings now. The last time we talked about this was in August, about a month ago. And we're going to continue on in his philosophical preliminaries section. And we're in a section called Historical Sources. And we have another section called Judicial Restraint versus Judicial Activism. Very important sections in this chapter called The Integrity of Constitutional Text, Chapter 3. Again, the book is called Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, published by Harvard University Press. We'd like to thank Richard A. Epstein for making this material available for writing it. Thank you, Richard. Thank you. We also like to thank Harvard University Press for publishing it. They do get some credit for that. And we would like to take a moment and honor the presence of physical books in our lives and how that changed world history. Don't take it for granted. Go get a copy of this today, whether it's used or new. Throw some money toward Harvard if you Harvard University Press for this book, not generally, but just for this book. Connect them to the market demand for good constitutional interpretation, because that's what keeps these books getting published. Okay. We're going to make a fair use of this material, do a transformative reading, and in our fair use of transform reading for nonprofit educational purposes only, I'd like you to pay attention. And if you have the book, follow along. If you don't have the book, consider getting it. Support your local bookstore, brick and mortar book dealer. Don't just put a river like the Nile or the Ganges or the Mississippi or Amazon to between you and your constitutional understanding. But since Amazon does typically have their crap together, I suppose I can't really blame you for going that route after all I did to get this. But just keep an eye out, at your local book dealer, throw them some business as much as you can because we need local book dealers, okay? That's all I'm going to say about that. Page 26, historical sources. The account just given places enormous stress upon the internal intellectual integrity of constitutional provision, of the constitutional provision, and does not take into account the actual historical intention of any of the parties who drafted or signed the document. One simple justification for this emphasis is that looking to those historical particulars is likely to generate more confusion than it eliminates. Constitutional documents are drafted by some persons and ratified by others. Many make speeches about the significance or function of a clause in order to ensure its passage. It's a physical book, and we love our physical books, but it does take some lifting. It's heavy, too. We're on page 27 at the top. I'll reread that sentence. Many make speeches about the significance or function of a clause in order to assure its passage. Ensure its passage. They may think that the provision has a very broad scope, but to deflect the opposition, they announce publicly that its scope is narrow. The same process works in reverse with statements of those opposed to the legislation. Thus, every bit of external evidence uses language which must be explicated and understood before it can be pressed into service to explain particular constitutional provisions. The use of extensive secondary materials, therefore, adds more raw data, but may well increase confusion rather than understanding. The point is not one of necessary truth, but one of basic probabilities. Sad that he has to say that. Where the number of parties is large and the divergence of views is great, the best evidence of textual intention is the language of the text itself. In part, these difficulties can be avoided if one looks to the writings of standard writers of the time. As I've indicated, that approach is strictly required in order to find out what the ordinary word means. But, well, the question is whether that technique can be pressed into service of some cause apart from textual explication, such as identifying the types of mischief that the provision is designed to forestall. One recurrent problem is that a constitutional provision may have been inspired by certain narrow examples that do not exhaust its meaning. The provisions on freedom of speech may have been motivated by outrage at government censorship of newspapers, but the language of the clause is far broader than the instance that gave rise to it. The language speaks of freedom of speech. And the modern cases that take this guarantee seriously try to give an account of individual freedom in the area of speech. The Establishment Clause surely imposes a restriction upon the designation of an official church, but it also reaches the partial establishments created by special assistance or support to particular or perhaps all religious groups. I don't know if that was that helpful of an example there, Richard. I'm just going to say the Establishment Clause was not really that interesting of an example. It's a little bit too. Yeah, there's no footnotes on that. You know what? We're going to let Richard slide on that. Richard, you get a pass on that, okay? You're doing a great job. We're going to continue. Page 27. The eminent domain clause raises the same issues. What's his main point here? His main point is when you're trying to figure out what a constitutional provision means, which is required for how it applies, you look at the text itself. Look at the language. Look at the Constitution. Look at what it says. And if you have a question about what those words mean, then you go to the sources for the semantic range of the word so that you can get a semantic understanding. You should understand the grammar. If the grammar's that bad, well, then we're going to have to, maybe there's some amphiboly there. And amphiboly could be a name of a logical fallacy where, from premises to conclusion, the preservation of truth value, whether probability or whatever it is weakened because of an unclarity related to grammar in the argument. Where that unclarity can be limited as much as possible, let's say you can narrow it down to two different possibilities, and either one is acceptable to you, well then you've solved the problem to some extent. Ideally, you want to have as clear a grammar as possible in a sentence, whether it's in an argument or not. You need to have clear grammar so that people understand what you're saying. But every once in a while, there is perhaps an unclarity where some sentence can be read two different ways because of the grammar. Whether it's grammar or semantics, whether it's grammar or meaning, whether it's morphology or the connotation of terms, where the connotation needs to be there in order to find out what the denotation is, that is the class of term, the class of objects that fall within the meaning of the term, or where the object could be, state of affairs. It could be actions like a verb or something like that. It could be a quality. So he's saying the text that was ratified is your primary object of analysis. And so far as you get into the historical sources, it can increase your misunderstanding. If you expect them to do too much, or if you expect it to be a straightforward, this guy said this, and so therefore the Constitution means that. If you start quoting individual people who helped draft the provision, or who maybe had a hand in advocating for its ratification or its defeat, you have to take the wider context into account in your discussion and argumentation of what the clause means and how to apply it now. All that I just said may be more confusing than what he originally said, which is why I like to let Richard talk. And if I'm hoping I helped, if I didn't, I'm sorry. The eminent domain clause raises the same issues. The dominant motivation for the clause may have been the taking of food and supplies during time of war for the support of government troops. Yet, this case is only an illustration of the abuse to be avoided. The language itself is far broader. There is some question about how broadly the language should be read. In his careful account of the historical background of the eminent domain clause, Joseph Sachs, Sax, observed that Grotius, that's a political philosopher in the modern period, Grotius believed that the extensive wage and price controls did not offend the eminent domain principle. But there is no reason to believe that Grotius's view of, I gotta change the page here. We're on page 28 at the top of the subject matter, was shared by others who faced the question, including those who drafted or ratified the amendment. Inference from a single writer to the constitutional text are at best troublesome. What if the writer is married and not single? LOL. Yet suppose that the common view of the time was that the takings of property excluded all regulation of wages and prices whatsoever. Why should the fact be decisive? The enacted provision did not state that these laws were to be within the absolute power of the legislature. It said that takings of private property must not be allowed unless compensated and then only for public use. The domain lo the dominant loyalty is to the text as written and not to the framers' views of the consequences it entailed. When the First or even the 14th Amendment was adopted, doubtless there was little sense that the common law rules of defamation were subject to constitutional revision. Yet, in the end, if the demands of freedom of speech render imperative some limitation upon private defamation suits, then the unwritten expectation of the framers, either the Bill of Rights or the 14th Amendment, must yield to the internal written logic of the text. Big picture is this is all a reflection on why it's important to have a written constitution and what follows from having a written constitution. It's similar to discussions that you might have in biblical studies where so-called, they're called conservatives. Okay, I don't like that term, but that's the term that's often used. Or sometimes orthodox is another term. I like that term better, but those who have a particularly high view of scripture focus on the text as written. And, historical sources are marshaled to help explain what that text means. Okay. And how it applies. You might have a living constitution type of attitude in some biblical scholars, and by the way, they're on the left, and those are called liberal scholars. I don't like that term either, but I just call them Democrats. I mean, I don't know what else to say. It's kind of funny if I call them a Democrat and they're like a monarchist in England, but that's just funny and ironic to me. They might discount the importance of the text altogether, as God's word. It's similar. We're trying to figure out what the word means, and we do prize written language because we think that the language is important and the language is what has authority. Take that for what it's worth. Okay. The same arguments apply in takings cases. There is, to be sure, a clear sense in which comprehensive wage and price controls differ from both selective controls on designated commodities on the one hand and from the takings of individual land for a post office on the other. Any adequate theory must explain what those differences are and how they tie into the general theory. But, and there's only one T, so don't get too excited, but it need not be assumed that these differences are categorical in nature, so that the confiscation of land is covered by the clause, while price controls, general or special, fall wholly outside of its scope. The best way to answer the question is to take a detailed look at the challenged practices to see how they tie into the eminent domain clause, treated as a self-contained intellectual proposition. Tell us how you really feel, Richard. Nor is this necessarily a rejection of the framers' intention. They may have meant to endorse both the takings clause and wages and price controls without knowing the implicit tension between them. Did you just hear that? I just heard it too. Let me just say that again. I'm going to repeat that. Talking about framers' intention, okay, and how that might help you read. So, read historical sources on framers' intention in order to help you understand the text of the Constitution. They, the framers, may have meant to endorse both the takings clause and wages and price controls without knowing the implicit tension between them. That is to say, it's possible that they ratified the text as we have it and preferred policies that go against it. Why? Because they didn't think through all the way. They were limited in time. They were limited in resources. They were cold. They were hot. There was no air conditioning. They were hungry. Whatever it was, they missed it. They're just people. Right? Now, hopefully, that didn't happen very often, but it is possible that that's what happened. That's what Richard is saying. What's authoritative? Their intentions or what they wrote and ratified? And the inner written logic of what they wrote and ratified. Basic constitutional law here, buddy. Basic, really basic. Back to basics on the Republican Professor podcast. This is boring. This is boring. I'm bored. Well, if you're so bored, then why do we have a million views on Twitter on this episode? Maybe there's something wrong with you. I just made that up about Twitter. I just wanted to see if how much attention span you had. Yeah. Okay, let's continue. If they cannot have both, then their explicit choice takes precedence over their silent one. Suppose the framers believed both A and X when A entails not X. If A is the constitutional text, then X is not allowed. Little propositional logic there, Richard. Not bad. Okay. All right. Little sentential logic, huh? Page 28 at the bottom. Categorical reliance upon historical intention must also confront the problem of novel institutions in changed social circumstances. The full range of legislative programs was wholly unknown to the framers. Good point. Very good point. That's a deep point. In other words, there was no New Deal back then. They didn't even contemplate there would be like a New Deal, that a number of Americans would want a New Deal kind of a thing. And in fact, it took a bunch of immigrants to get that stuff passed. It was immigrants from other parts of Europe that got the New Deal coalition over the top there. If you don't know what the New Deal is, I'm sorry, I can't help you in this one. You're too far behind. It's a gross expansion, a radical expansion of the role of the federal government in the lives of ordinary people. That's just, and it was all Democrats. Okay. Little by little, we're getting you understanding, get your understanding up there. The full range of legislative programs was wholly unknown to the framers, who were never exposed to the mysteries of rent control, workers' compensation, the pooling of oil and gas interests, or the intricacies of zoning. You know that zoning laws are entirely new in the 1900s, okay? Yep. They didn't exist at the founding, the framing. Any effort to make some specific historical intention the litmus test for the constitutionality of such programs drives us toward one of two unacceptable extremes. Switching places. I always want to stop listening and watching when you take a pause, because I want to have constant. I want to have constant entertainment and constant reading, because otherwise it's boring. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. If it's so boring, why do we have, why does this have a billion views on Instagram? I just made that up, but you're probably not listening anyway, so who cares? Page 29 at the top. Novel institutions like the New Deal, that's me, are either always valid or always invalid. Man, tell us what you really think, Richard. What Richard is saying is the New Deal invalid, and it was then and it is now. Goes against the Constitution, which is a very anti-democratic party thing to say. And he's from New York. He's got a New York accent. He's ethnically Jewish. His parents were in the constituency of the New Deal, and his grandparents probably too. Well, maybe not his grandparents. They might not have been here. I don't know. Yet one reason, to use very general language in the takings clause, is to avoid just these categorical judgments, thereby allowing principled adjudication to pass upon institutions not yet known to the framers. I like where you're going with this, Richard. The quest for some specific historical intention is thus wholly misplaced. Amen, brother. Preach it. This is like a Billy Graham sermon. The form of words chosen for the Bill of Rights indicates that the framers were as aware of the problem of legislative innovation as we are. They knew that they could not know the future and drafted accordingly. There is then a certain proper attitude of ambivalence toward historical sources. They are exceedingly helpful in allowing us to understand the standard meanings of ordinary language as embodied in constitutional text, but they are a very imperfect tool for isolating the collective purposes and hidden agendas that secured its passage. They are of even less value in evaluating particular institutional arrangements that must be scrutinized under the clause. Generalizations about the prospective use of these sources are hard to come by, but their limited value seems especially well established with the eminent domain clause. Historical arguments have played virtually no role in the actual interpretation of the clause. To my knowledge, the Supreme Court has never resorted to historical sources to explain the relationship between the eminent domain clause and particular government action. Interesting. Nor is that surprising. It is very clear that the founders shared Locke's and Blackstone's affection for private property and the Bibles, I would say. You know, if you've listened to these episodes on this book so far, I went on about the Bible and private property, so I'm not going to relitigate that here. But the Bible, too, thou shalt not steal, that implies private property. It's very clear that the founders shared Locke's and Blackstone's affection for private property and the Bible, which is why they inserted the eminent domain provision in the Bill of Rights. Nonetheless, most of the discussion about the Bill of Rights was directed not to its substantive commands, but to the procedural question of whether so fundamental a shift in constitutional design should be undertaken before the original Constitution had a chance to prove itself in operation. The justification for given for the constitutional provisions were general in terms, as was fitting under the circumstances. The question of what the specific clauses meant and how they applied in particular situations was left to future generations. Indeed, insisting upon a bill of particulars could have prevented the passage of the Bill of Rights in its entirety. I like this section, Richard. Nice job. Nice job. Judicial restraint and judicial activism. Now, if you're just a young whippersnapper and you've never got on YouTube and, you know, poked around in some of the 80s debates on judicial restraint versus judicial activism, and maybe even before the 1970s and 1960s of sources back then, you know, for example, the Bork hearings. I listened to all those on UBoob when I was a professor and I had very long commutes, and so it was perfect. I just pull up YouTube, put it in my ear, listen while I'm driving. Lots of time to listen to Clarence Thomas's hearings. There's lots of stuff out there on this. And it comes up in protection of property rights because the question is about the role of the court in enforcing these provisions of the Constitution when it goes so against what the legislature wants. Now, you would think that the Constitution is there to protect us from what the legislature wants. I mean, that's the whole point of a Constitution that's written. It's to be that thing that stands between you and your rights. That is a bare majority in the legislature. Your constitutional rights. And the legislatures might want to do good. They might want to get, they might get up, they might shave, especially the women nowadays, and put on a coat and tie and high heels and lipstick and put their little poodle in their purse and go vote on a bill, and they might have the best intentions but the worst effects because they were grade inflated and they partied too much in college and they can't think, they're too busy and they have their face in Twitter and they don't think deeply enough and they don't hire staff that thinks deeply. Or maybe they do have a couple of staffers that do, but they don't listen to them because they're the one people that don't go to the parties. You know what I mean, Vern? So they make mistakes. Well, isn't that what the point of the Constitution is? But the Constitution has to be enforced. Who's going to enforce it? Well, in a case or controversy, when it goes to court, the judges are supposed to enforce it, right? Don't you think? I mean, I'm not saying only judges do. The president has a role, the Congress has a role. Future Congresses can correct what past Congresses did. For example, this Congress can repeal the NFA, the National Firearms Act, because that was a piece of crap. You know what I mean? The president could just refuse to enforce the NFA because he thinks it's unconstitutional. But to have the lasting, I mean, in a case or controversy in court, the judges are supposed to do it. Well, there's a bunch of so-called conservatives that think that the judges are supposed to just go by precedent, value stare decisis, be very limited. They don't want activist judges enforcing their quote-unquote policy preference. But what about when their quote unquote policy preference just is the Constitution? Then they are supposed to enforce their policy preference. And they're supposed to be active. They're supposed to be activist when it counts. That's what Richard is going to say, I think. You tell me if I got that right. Page 29 at the bottom. What presumption, if any, should be brought to any statute challenged under the eminent domain clause? Ooh, getting excited here. Here, the choice has been described as one between judicial activism and judicial restraint, depending upon the. Got to change pages.
This is where I want to just I you took too long, so I want to go look at Twitter now.
Well, you're great inflated, so I don't care about having you as a listener or a viewer. So don't let the door hit you on the way out. Way in which the presumption is set. Let me read that whole sentence. Here, the choice has been described as one between judicial activism and judicial restraint, depending upon the way in which the presumption is set. We're on page 30 at the top. In principle, any initial presumption operates as a default provision, one that governs whenever textual and historical arguments do not give firm, conclusive direction one way or the other. The traditional argument in favor of judicial restraint is that choices over economic matters are best left to representatives of the people chosen by democratic procedures. There's a footnote. Dare I look at the footnote? It's Robert Bork. Course, if you have the book, you're going to see the footnote. So, what do you need me to tell you? The argument for judicial activism rests upon the perception that flaws in the democratic process lead to the deprivation of individual rights, including those of property. There's a wonderful footnote there, John Hart Ely, Democracy and Distrust, A Theory of Judicial Review. Okay, all right, okay. I haven't read that book, but I've read John Hart Ely on Roe versus Wade when it first came out. The emphasis upon democracy tends to lead to a rational basis test that offers so little scrutiny that most legislation passes constitutional muster as a matter of course. Emphasis upon the imperfections of government leads to strict scrutiny and more extensive judicial activism. Now, in my margin of the book, I have this whole thing bracketed and quotation mark. Pay attention. There is no way one side to this debate can vanquish the other in the abstract. The Constitution contains provisions designed to ensure that some decisions will be made by elected representatives. It also contains provisions designed to limit the powers of these same elected representatives. The traditional debate is often cast in the wrong terms by assuming that either activism or restraint gives a decent first approximation of the proper results. The Constitution clearly does not endorse any version of popular democracy. Yet, by the same token, it does not assume that legislatures have no task to perform. That's really wonderfully said. We can never do without presumptions, but it may be possible to limit their scope. Presumptions are needed only in the absence of more specific knowledge, and that is what we should seek to acquire. The rules that govern analysis should emerge from the interpretation of the text rather than be imposed upon it. Sounds like the old exegesis versus eisegesis debates in biblical studies and theology. I like where you're going with this, Richard. As analysis of the underlying text becomes more precise, the presumption recedes in importance as there is less need to resort to the default provisions. Cases are decided more on the basis of theory and less on the upon the initial stylized conception of judicial role. The debate between judicial activism and restraint takes a far smaller role and is confined in the end, I believe, to cases in which there is genuine doubt about how difficult institutional arrangements square with well-established and well-formed constitutional rules. This is all so good. This is excellent. In what follows, I shall advocate a level of judicial intervention far greater than we have now. Yeah. Oh, we're going to have quite a time here on this. We're going to have quite a time. Why do you think we spend so much time looking at court decisions? It's not the only reason, but it's a big one. Let me just say something about future episodes here. We're doing the Chevron deference stuff. Well, that overturning Chevron deference brings the judicial activism to the fore on the administrative state, at least, which is exactly what two scholars advocated for back in 2019. My professor, Michael Uhlman, talks about it in Claremont Review of Books in his book, well, in his review of Peter Wallison's book, Judicial Fortitude. We're not going to get to that book yet. We have too many things going on. I'd rather do Wallison's book on the financial crisis first. We'll do Uhlman's review of that book, Judicial Fortitude, and how it links with the Chevron deference doctrine. But this is all related. It's all hanging together, man. So in what follows, I shall advocate a level of judicial intervention far greater than we have now, and indeed far greater than we ever have had. But at no point does the argument depend upon a belief in judicial activism in cases of economic liberties. Instead, I believe that the courses indicated are necessary implications derived from the constitutional text and the underlying theory of the state that it embodies. Okay.
You took too long to go to the next page. So I'm out of here, man. I'm gonna go to Instagram. I'm gonna go to TikTok.
Don't let the door hit you on the way out, buddy. We're on page 31 at the top. The agenda. How then is this theory constructed? As noted earlier, The Constitution draws on the basic theory developed by Locke. In that theory, the government was conceived in the first instance as deriving all of its rights and powers from the individuals whom it governs. Accordingly, all arrangements between the state and private individuals are broken down into a network of relationships among different individuals. That approach is critical for understanding two key aspects of the eminent domain equation. First, what does it mean to take private property? And second, what possible justifications can be invoked when private property is taken? Nonetheless, the state is more than the sum of the parts because those invested with official power are allowed to initiate forced exchanges for public use. The third and fourth questions therefore confront the regulation of forced exchanges through the public use and just compensation provisions. In large measure, the agenda can be reduced to four questions. One, is there a taking of private property? This is for cases and controversies that go into court. This, thus, the role of the judge and activism versus restraint, which has to be determined by the meaning of the Constitution as applied to that case, not a preliminary philosophical assumption of the role of judges or whatever by itself. Okay, in large measure, the agenda can be reduced to four questions. One, is there a taking of private property? Two, is there any justification for taking that private property? Three, is the taking for a public use? Four, is there any compensation for the property so taken? These questions are taken up in sequence and in combination in the rest of the book. That's what the book is about. Let me read that agenda again. And this is the end of this chapter. This is page 31. Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain by Richard A. Epstein, published 1985 by Harvard University Press. We'd like to thank Harvard University Press for making this material available. We'd like to thank Richard A. Epstein for writing it. He expended a lot of effort and energy writing this. You probably don't even have the energy to listen to it, let alone write it. Okay. In large measure, the agenda can be reduced to four questions. One, is there a taking of private property? Two, is there any justification for taking that private property? Three, is the taking for public use? Four, is there any compensation for the property so taken? These questions are taken up in sequence and in combination in the rest of the book. I'm excited. I've read this before and I'm excited. I've read this multiple times and I'm excited. And I hope you're excited too. The next part is part two, takings prima facie. And the next chapter title is Takings and Torts, Chapter 4. Thanks for joining me on The Republican Professor. Get a copy of this book. Throw some business toward Harvard University Press. Please support your local bookstore. This is the book, Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, published by Harvard University Press, 1985. 40 years ago, it's the 40th anniversary. Written by Richard A. Epstein. Richard A. Epstein is the host of, well, he's one of the guests. Is he a host or a guest? I don't know. Law Talk, which is excellent with John Yoo. And he does one, he did one on reasonable disagreements with Adam White, who's with the Gray Center. Study the administrative state, I think George Mason. And the libertarian, it used to be with Hoover, and now I think it's with the University of Texas, Austin. And by the way, If there's anybody at the University of Texas at Austin or Hoover that's listening to this, what the hell happened to the back episodes of The Libertarian? What, where are they? You guys, let me go off on a rant here. You got to keep these episodes available for people to refer back to. This is valuable material. You know? It's as tacky as a librarian going through a library and just randomly, you know, taking old books off and just putting boxes in and, you know, putting them in storage. What the hell is the point of having a library if you do that? A library is not supposed to be Barnes and Noble. Hoover, University of Texas, whatever. I don't know what it is with these older episodes, but just get your crap together. And let me go off on a couple of other guys that I otherwise like, okay? Dr. Mark Barkey, Dr. Jeff Barkey, Dr. Mark McDonald. I love you guys, but you guys need to get the crack pipe out of your mouth in terms of making your older episodes available. Your episodes going back to 2021 were available as of whatever, 9 months ago or whatever, and then they just disappeared off of Apple Podcasts. Do you know what a disservice that is to the entire country? As you got really curious people trying to figure out what the hell happened? Make that stuff available. What are you doing? Are you trying to save money? I mean, come on, guys, you're medical doctors. You're going to have to take one for the team on that one. We appreciate everything you did, but what is the point if you hide it from people that are looking for it? Oh my gosh, or don't know enough to look for it. They don't know what they're missing. And then David Bahnsen of National Review's Capitol Record. I don't know how much of this is in your control. I have no idea what National Review is doing, but whatever it is, your episodes are a disaster in terms of the archive. I'm not talking about the content. I'm not talking about the. It's great. I listen to it. Where the hell are the old episodes? Are you trying to save money? Are you trying to sell subscriptions or something? This is ridiculous. You guys have enough. Dave, you have enough money. Make the episodes available. Do you realize the disservice taking those episodes down does to the entire country? To someone like me, I want to reflect on, write Substack articles about what you're saying. I can't put the links in there because the links are bad within a month. What the hell are you doing? Pull your head out of your butt. You want a model on who does this well? Russ Roberts, Econ Talk. Go on Apple Podcasts. You can find it going back to freaking 2006, man. And that's where I started. When I started listening to Econ Talk, I went to episode number one, just like I would a book. And guess what? I can write Substack articles about those episodes and put links. And you know what? People can listen to them decade later. And they're growing their audience little by little. It's almost like you have something to hide or something. Are you embarrassed about the older episodes? For goodness sake, man. You guys. I'm going to rail on you guys until you get it. You really need a drill instructor to yell and scream in your face right now. I did archival research methods for one of my research tools at the PhD level, and I can tell you, man, the archives are extremely important to be made available. Do it. No excuses. Back to basics. We'll see you next time. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. This is the Republican Professor Podcast, Tuesday, 23 September, 2025, years after Jesus.